The whispers and quiet play of the shadows outside could just barely be heard.
"I've built up favors and favors with supply over the years," he explained. "Favors and favors. So I called them all in, told them we'd be even."
He looked at this group of men and women from Mechanical, could hear more standing in the hallway who'd arrived late, but could read from the frozen demeanors in the room to stay put.
"We've taken stuff out of IT's supply chain before. I know I have. All the best electronics and wire go to them that make the suits."
"The rat shit bastards," someone muttered,
which got more than a few of them bobbing their heads.
"So I told supply to return the favor. Soon as I heard they took her."
Walker paused and swiped at his eyes.
"Soon as I heard, I wired in those favors, said to replace anything them bastards asked for with some of our own. Best of the best, and don't let them be wiser."
"You did what?"
Knox asked. Walker dipped his head over and over, feeling good to let out the truth.
"They've been making those suits to fail. Not 'cause it ain't bad out there, that's not what I figure, but they don't want your body wandering out of sight. No, sir."
He stirred his oats.
"They want us all right here where they can see us."
"So she's okay?" Shirley asked. Walker frowned and slowly shook his head.
"I told you guys," someone said. "She'd run out of air by now."
"She was dead anyway," someone else countered, and the argument began to build again.
"This just proves they're full of shit."
Walker had to agree with that.
"Everybody, hey! Let's stay calm,"
Knox roared. But he appeared the least calm of them all. More workers filed in now that the moment of silence appeared to be over. They gathered around the table, faces full of worry.
"This is it,"
Walker said to himself, seeing what was happening, what he had started. He watched his friends and co-workers get all riled up, barking at the empty air for answers, their passions stirred.
"This is it,"
he said again, and he could feel it brewing, ready to burst out.
"This is it, this is it."
Courtney, still hovering over him, tended to him like he was an invalid, held his wrist with those delicate hands of hers.
"What is it?"
she asked. She waved down the others so she could hear. She leaned close to Walker.
"Walk, tell me, what is it? What is this? What are you trying to say?"
"This is how it starts,"
he whispered, the room quiet once more. He looked up at all the faces, scanned them, seeing in their fury, in all the exploded taboos, that he was right to worry.
"This is how the uprising begins."
7. Sharp misery had worn him to the bones, and about his shelves, a beggarly account of empty boxes. Lucas arrived at 34, breathless and clutching the small box, more exhausted from the laws he had broken than his habitual climb to work. He could still taste the metallic tang of adrenaline in his mouth from hiding behind the servers and rummaging through Juliet's things. He patted his chest, feeling the items there, and also his racing heart. Once he was better composed, he reached for the doors to IT and nearly cracked a knuckle as they flew outward toward him. Sammy, a tech he knew, burst out in a hurry and stormed past. Lucas called his name, but the older tech was already gone, storming up the stairs and out of sight. There was more commotion in the entrance hall, voices yelling over one another. Lucas entered warily, wondering what the fuss was about. He held open the door with his elbow and slid into the room, the box tight against his chest. Most of the yelling, it seemed, was coming from Bernard. The head of IT stood outside the security gates and barked at one tech after the other. Nearby, Sims, the head of IT security, similarly lit into three men in gray coveralls. Lucas remained frozen by the door, intimidated by the angry duo. When Bernard spotted him there, he snapped shut and waded through the trembling techs to greet him. Lucas opened his mouth to say something, but his boss was fixated less on him and more on what was in his hands.
"This is it?"
Bernard asked, snatching the box from him.
"It?"
"Everything that greaser owned fits in this little damn box?"
Bernard tugged the flaps open.
"Is this everything?"
That's what I was given," Lucas stammered. Marsh said,
"Yeah, the deputy wired about his cramps. I swear the pack should stipulate an age limit for their kind. Sims!"
Bernard turned to his security chief.
"Conference room, now."
Lucas pointed toward the security gate and the server room beyond.
"I suppose I should get to..."
"Come with me,"
Bernard said, wrapping his arm around Lucas's back and squeezing his shoulder.
"I want you in on this. There seem to be fewer and fewer rat-shit techs I can trust around here."
"Unless you want me on the servers. We had that thing with Tower 13.
"That can wait. This is more important."
Bernard ushered him toward the conference room, the hulking mass of Sims preceding them. The security guard grabbed the door and held it open, frowning at Lucas as he went by. Lucas shivered as he crossed the threshold. He could feel the sweat running down his chest, could feel guilty heat in his armpits and around his neck. He had a sudden image of being thrown against the table, pinned down, contraband yanked from his pockets and waved in his face.
"Sit,"
Bernard said. He put the box down on the table, and he and Sims began disgorging its contents while Lucas lowered himself into a chair.
"Vacation chits,"
Sims said, pulling out the stack of paper coupons. Lucas watched the way the man's arms rippled with muscle with even the slightest movement. Sims had been a tech once, until his body kept growing and made him too obviously suited for other, less cerebral endeavors. He lifted the chits to his nose, took a sniff, and recoiled.
"Smells like sweaty greaser,"
he said.
"Counterfeit?"
Bernard asked. Sims shook his head. Bernard was inspecting the small wooden box. He shook it and rapped it with his knuckles, listening to the rattle of chits inside. He searched the exterior for a hinge or clasp. Lucas almost blurted out that the top slid, that it was so finely crafted you could barely see the joints, and that it took a bit of effort. Bernard muttered something and set the box aside.
"What exactly are we looking for?" Lucas asked.
He leaned forward and grabbed the box, pretended to be inspecting it for the first time.
"Anything. A fucking clue," Bernard barked.
He glared at Lucas.
"How did this greaser make it over the hill? Was it something she did? One of my techs? What?"
Lucas still couldn't figure the anger. So what if she hadn't cleaned? It would have been a double anyway. Was Bernard pissed because he didn't know why she'd survived so long? This made sense to Lucas. Whenever he fixed something by accident, it drove him nearly as nuts as having something break. And he'd seen Bernard angry before, but this was something different. The man was livid. He was manic. It's just how Lucas would feel if he'd had such an unprecedented piece of success with no cause to pin it on. Sims, meanwhile, found the notebook and began flipping through it.
"Hey, boss."
Bernard snatched it from him and tore through the pages, reading.
"Someone'll have to go through all of this,"
he said. He pushed his glasses up his nose.
"There might be some sign of collusion in here."
"Hey, look," Lucas said, holding out the box. "It opens." He showed them the sliding lid.
"Let me see that."
Bernard dropped the notebook to the table and snatched the wooden box away. He wrinkled his nose.
"Just chits,"
he said disgustingly. He dumped them on the table and was about to toss the box aside, but Sims grabbed it from him.
"That's an antique," the large man said. "You think it's a clue, or can I..."
"Yes, keep it by all means,"
Bernard waved his arms out toward the window with its view of the entrance hall.
"Because nothing of greater fucking importance is going on around here, is it, shit for brains?"
Sims shrugged noncommittally and slid the wooden box into his pocket. Lucas desperately wanted to be somewhere else, anywhere in the silo but there.
"Maybe she just got lucky," Sims offered.
Bernard began dumping the rest of the box onto the table, shaking it to loosen the manual that Lucas knew was tightly wedged in the bottom. He paused from his efforts and squinted at Sims over the rims of his glasses.
"Lucky?"
Bernard repeated. Sims tilted his head.
"Get the fuck out of here,"
Bernard told him. Sims nodded.
"Yeah, you're right."
"No, I mean get out."
Bernard pointed at the door.
"Get the fuck out."
The head of security smiled like this was funny, but lumbered for the door. He slid out of the room and gently clicked the door shut behind him.
"I'm surrounded by morons,"
Bernard said once they were alone. Lucas tried to imagine this was not meant as an insult directed at him.
"Present company excluded,"
Bernard added, as if reading his mind. "Thanks."
"Hey, at least you can fix a goddamn server. What the hell do I pay these other rat shit techs to do?"
He pressed his glasses up the bridge of his nose again, and Lucas tried to remember if the IT head had always cursed this much. He didn't think so. Was it the strain of being interim mayor that was getting to him? Something had changed. It felt strange to even consider Bernard his friend anymore. The man was so much more important now, so much busier. Perhaps he was cracking under the stress that came with the extra responsibility. The pain of being the one to send good people to cleaning.
"You know why I've never taken a shadow?"
Bernard asked. He flipped through the manual, saw the play on the reverse side, and turned the bound sheets of paper around. He glanced up at Lucas, who lifted his palms and shrugged.
"It's because I shudder to think of anyone else ever running this place."
Lucas assumed he meant IT, not the silo. Bernard hadn't been mayor very long. Bernard set the play down and gazed out the window where muffled voices argued once more.
"But I'll have to, one of these days. I'm at that age where your friends, the people you grew up with, are dropping like flies, but you're still young enough to pretend it won't happen to you."
His eyes fell to Lucas. The young tech felt uncomfortable being alone with Bernard. He'd never felt that before.
"Silos have burned to the ground before because of one man's hubris," Bernard told him. "All it takes is improper planning, thinking you'll be around forever. But because one man disappears," he snapped his fingers, "and leaves a sucking void behind, that can be enough to bring it all down."
Lucas was dying to ask his boss what the hell he was talking about.
"Today is that day, I think."
Bernard walked around the long conference table, leaving behind him the scattered remnants of Juliet's life. Lucas's gaze drifted over the items. The guilt of going through them vanished to see how they'd been treated. He wished, instead, that he'd stashed away more of them.
"What I need is someone who already has access to the servers," Bernard said.
Lucas turned to the side and realized the short, full-bellied head of IT was standing right beside him. He moved his hand up to his chest pocket, making sure it didn't bulge open where Bernard could see.
"Sammy is a good tech. I trust him, but he's nearly as old as I am."
"You aren't that old," Lucas said, trying to be polite, to gather his wits. He wasn't sure what was going on.
"There's not many people I consider a friend,"
Bernard said. "I appreciate that."
"You're probably the closest thing."
"I feel the same."
"I knew your father. He was a good man."
Lucas swallowed and nodded. He looked up at Bernard and realized the man was holding out his hand. Had been for a while. He reached out his own to accept, still not sure what was being offered.
I need a shadow, Lucas.
Bernard's hand felt small in Lucas's own. He watched as his arm was pumped up and down.
I want you to be that man.
8. Wisely and slow, they stumble that run fast. Juliet forced her way through the inner airlock door and scrambled to get it closed. Darkness overwhelmed her as the heavy door squealed on its hinges and settled against its dry seals. She groped for the large locking wheel and leaned on the spokes, spinning it and sealing the door tight. The air in her suit was growing stale. She could feel the dizziness overtaking her. Turning around, keeping one hand on the wall, she stumbled forward through the darkness. The puff of outside air that she'd allowed inside seemed to claw at her back like a horde of mad insects. Juliet staggered blindly down the hallway, trying to put distance between herself and the dead she'd left behind. There were no lights on, no glow from the wall screens with their view of the outside world. She'd prayed the layout was the same, that she could find her way. She prayed the air in her suit would hold out a moment longer, prayed the air in the silo wasn't as foul and toxic as the wind outside, or, and just as bad, that the air in the silo wasn't as devoid of oxygen as what little remained in her suit. Her hand brushed the bars of a cell just where they should be, giving her hope that she could navigate the darkness. She wasn't sure what she'd hope to find in the pitch black. She had no plan for salvation. She was simply stumbling away from the horrors outside. It hardly registered for her that she had been there, had gone outside, and now was in someplace new. As she fumbled through the office, sucking on the last breaths of air in her helmet, her feet knocked into something, and Juliet went sprawling forward. She landed roughly on a soft mound, groped with her hand, and felt an arm. A body. Several bodies. Juliet crawled over them, the spongy flesh feeling more human and solid than the husks and bones outside, and more difficult to move across. She felt someone's chin. The weight of her body caused their neck to turn, and she nearly lost her balance. Her body recoiled at the sensation of what she was doing, the reflex to apologize, to pull her limbs away, but she forced herself forward over a pile of them, through the darkness, until her helmet slammed into the office door. The blow was hard enough and so without warning that Juliet saw stars and feared blacking out. She reached up and fumbled for the handle. Her eyes might as well have been sealed shut, the utter darkness was so complete. Even the bowels of mechanical had never seen such deep and perfect shadow. She found the latch and pushed. The door was unlocked but wouldn't budge. Juliet scrambled to her feet, her boots digging into lifeless bodies, and threw her shoulder against the door. She wanted out. The door moved. A little. She could feel something slide on the other side and imagined more bodies piled up. She threw herself again and again into the door, grunts of effort and frustrated tiny screams echoing in her helmet. Her hair was loose, sweaty, and matting to her face. She couldn't see, couldn't breathe, was growing more faint as she poisoned her own internal atmosphere. When the door slid open a crack, she tried to force her way through, one shoulder first, squeezing her helmet past, then pulling her other arm and leg after. She fell to the floor, scrambled around, and shoved herself against the door, sealing it tight. There was a dim light, almost impossible to notice at first. A barricade of tables and chairs were pressed in against her, scattered from her efforts to get through. Their hard edges and spindly legs seemed intent on ensnaring her. Juliet heard herself wheezing for air and knew her time had run out. She imagined the poison all over her like grease. The toxic air that she'd let in was a cloud of vermin, just waiting for her to crawl out of her shell so they could eat away at her. She considered lying down and letting her air supply run out instead. She would be preserved in this chrysalis of a suit, a well-built suit, a gift from Walker and the people of Supply. Her body would lie forever in this dim silo that shouldn't exist, but so much better than to rot on a lifeless hill and fly away, piece by piece, on a fickle breeze. It would be a good death. She panted, proud of herself for making it somewhere of her own choosing, for conquering these last few obstacles. Slumping against the door, she very nearly laid down and closed her eyes, but for the nagging of her curiosity. Juliet held up her hands and studied them in the dim glow from the stairwell. The shiny gloves, wrapped in heat tape and melted to form a bright skin, made her look like a machine of sorts. She ran her hands over the dome of her helmet, realizing she was like a walking toaster. When she had been a mere shadow and mechanical, she'd had a bad habit of taking things apart, even those that already worked. What had Walker said of her? That she liked nothing more than peering inside of toasters. Juliet sat up and tried to focus. She was losing sensation, and with it, the will to live. She shook her head and pulled herself to her feet, sent a pile of chairs crashing to the floor. She was the toaster, she realized. Her curiosity wanted it open. This time, to see what was outside. To take one breath and know. She swam through the tables and chairs, wanting more and more distance between herself and any bad air she had let in. The bodies she had crawled over in the sheriff's office had felt whole, naturally dead, trapped inside and starved or asphyxiated, perhaps, but not rotten. Still, and despite her lightheadedness and need to breathe, she wanted to somehow douse herself before cracking the helmet. She escaped the barrier of tables and chairs and made her way across the open cafeteria floor. The emergency lights in the stairwell leaked a green glow to dimly show the way. She passed through the serving door and into the kitchen and tried the taps on the large sink. The handles turned, but the spout didn't leak a drop, didn't knock with even a futile try from distant pumps. She went to the dangling hose over the dish station and pulled that lever, and was similarly rewarded. There was no water. Her next thought was the walk-ins, to maybe freeze the nastiness she could feel crawling all over her suit. She staggered around the cooking stations and pulled the large silver handle on the door, her breath wheezy in her helmet. The light in the back reaches of the kitchen was already so dim she could barely see. She couldn't feel any cold through her suit, but wasn't sure if she'd be able to. It was built to shield her, and built well. The overhead light didn't come on, so she assumed the freezer was dead. With the door open, she peered inside, looking for anything fluid, and saw what looked like vats of soup. She was desperate enough to try anything. Juliet moved inside the walk-in, letting the door swing slowly shut behind her. She seized one of the large plastic containers, a bucket the size of the largest cooking pots, and tore the top off. The door clicked shut, returning her to solid darkness. Juliet knelt beneath the shelf and tipped the massive bucket over. She could feel the liquid soup splatter all over her suit, crinkling it and splashing to the floor. Her knees slipped in the stuff. She felt for the next one and did the same, ran her fingers into the puddles and coated herself in it. There was no way of knowing if she was being crazy, if she was making things worse, or if any of it mattered. Her boot slipped, sending her flat on her back, her helmet cracking against the floor. Juliet lay there in a puddle of tepid soup, unable to see, her breath raspy and stale. Her time had run out. She was dizzy and could think of nothing else to try. Didn't have the breath or energy anyway. The helmet had to come off. She fumbled for the latches, could barely feel them through her gloves. Her gloves were too thick. They were going to kill her. She rolled to her belly and crawled through the soup, her hands and knees slipping. She reached the door, gasping, and fumbled for the handle, found it, threw the door open. There was a rack of knives gleaming behind the counter. She lurched to her feet and grabbed one, held the blade in her thick mitts, and slumped to the floor, exhausted and dizzy. Turning the blade toward her own neck, Juliet groped for the latch. She slid the point along her collar until it caught in the crack of the button. Steadying herself, her arm shaking, she moved the knife and pressed in, shoving it toward her body against all physical revulsion at the act. There was a faint click. Juliet gasped and groped along the rim with the blade for the other button until she found it. She repeated the maneuver. Another click, and her helmet popped off. Juliet's body took over for her, urging deep gulps of foul air. The stench was unbearable, but she couldn't stop gasping for more. Rotted food, biological decay, a tepid filth of stenches invaded her mouth, tongue, nose. She turned to the side and retched, but nothing came out. Her hands were still slippery with soup. Breathing was painful. She imagined a burning sensation on her skin, but it could have been her fevered state. She crawled away from the walk-in, toward the cafeteria, out of the fog of rotting soup, before she managed a gulp of air. Air. She took another lungful, the odor still overpowering, the soup coating her. But beyond the stench, something else was there. Something faint. Something breathable that began to force away the dizziness and the panic. It was oxygen. Life. Juliet was still alive. She laughed a mad laugh and stumbled toward the stairwell, drawn to the green glow of light, breathing deeply and too exhausted to appreciate this, the impossible life still in her. 9. For you and I are past our dancing days. Nox saw the uproar in mechanical as just another emergency to overcome. Like the time the basement subwall sprung a leak, or when the oil rig hit that pocket of methane and they had to evacuate 8 levels until the air handlers made it safe to return. Against the inevitable flow of commotion, what he needed to do was push for order, to assign tasks. He had to break a huge undertaking down to discrete bits and make sure they all fell to the right hands. Only this time, he and his people wouldn't be setting out to repair something. There were things the good people of Mechanical meant to break.
Supply is the key,